This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Read by Edward Herman.
Preface. I began this book 7 years ago with the notion of writing about Theodore Roosevelt and the Progressive Era. This desire had been kindled nearly 4 decades earlier when I was a young professor teaching a seminar on the Progressives. There are but a handful of times in the history of our country when there occurs a transformation so remarkable that a molt seems to take place, and an altered country begins to emerge. The turn of the 20th century was such a time, and Theodore Roosevelt is counted among our greatest presidents, one of the few to attain that eminence without having surmounted some pronounced national crisis, revolution, war, widespread national depression. To be sure, Roosevelt had faced a pernicious underlying crisis, one as pervasive as any military conflict or economic collapse. In the wake of the Industrial Revolution, an immense gulf had opened between the rich and the poor. Daily existence had become more difficult for ordinary people, and the middle class felt increasingly squeezed. Yet, by the end of Roosevelt's tenure in the White House, a mood of reform had swept the country, creating a new kind of presidency and a new vision of the relationship between the government and the people. A series of antitrust suits had been won, and legislation passed to regulate railroads, strengthen labor rights, curb political corruption, end corporate campaign contributions, impose limits on the working day, protect consumers from unsafe food and drugs, and conserve vast swaths of natural resources for the American people. The question that most intrigued me was how Roosevelt had managed to rouse a Congress long wedded to the reigning concept of laissez-faire, a government interfering as little as possible in the economic and social life of the people, to pass such comprehensive measures. The essence of Roosevelt's leadership, I soon became convinced, lay in his enterprising use of the bully pulpit, a phrase he himself coined to describe the national platform the presidency provides to shape public sentiment and mobilize action. Early in Roosevelt's tenure, Lyman Abbott, editor of The Outlook, joined a small group of friends in the president's library to offer advice and criticism on a draft of his upcoming message to Congress. He had just finished a paragraph of a distinctly ethical character, Abbott recalled, when he suddenly stopped, swung round in his swivel chair, and said, "I suppose my critics will call that preaching, but I have got such a bully pulpit." From this bully pulpit, Roosevelt would focus the charge of a national movement to apply an ethical framework through government action to the untrammeled growth of modern America. Roosevelt understood from the outset that this task hinged upon the need to develop powerfully reciprocal relationships with members of the national press. He called them by their first names, invited them to meals, took questions during his midday shave, welcomed their company at day's end while he signed correspondence, and designated, for the first time, a special room for them in the West Wing. He brought them aboard his private railroad car during his regular swings around the country. At every village station, he reached the hearts of the gathered crowds with homespun language, aphorisms, and direct moral appeals. Accompanying reporters then extended the reach of Roosevelt's words in national publications. Such extraordinary rapport with the press did not stem from calculation alone. Long before and after he was president, Roosevelt was an author and historian. From an early age, he read as he breathed. He knew and revered writers, and his relationship with journalists was authentically collegial. In a sense, he was one of them. While exploring Roosevelt's relationship with the press, I was especially drawn to the remarkably rich connections he developed with a team of journalists, including Ida Tarbell, Ray Stanyard Baker, Lincoln Steffens, and William Allen White, all working at McClure's magazine, the most influential contemporary progressive publication. The restless enthusiasm and manic energy of their publisher and editor, S.S. McClure, infused the magazine with a spark of genius, even as he suffered from periodic nervous breakdowns. "The story is the thing," Sam McClure responded when asked to account for the methodology behind his publication. He wanted his writers to begin their research without preconceived notions, to carry their readers through their own process of discovery. As they educated themselves about the social and economic inequities rampant in the wake of teeming industrialization, so they educated the entire country. Together, these investigative journalists, who would later appropriate Roosevelt's derogatory term, muckraker, as a badge of honor, produced a series of exposés that uncovered the invisible web of corruption linking politics to business. McClure's formula, giving his writers the time and resources they needed to produce extended, intensively researched articles, was soon adopted by rival magazines. Collectively, this generation of gifted writers ushered in a new mode of investigative reporting, a golden age of journalism that provided the necessary conditions to make a genuine bully pulpit of the American presidency. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that the progressive mind was characteristically a journalistic mind, historian Richard Hofstadter observed, and that its characteristic contribution was that of the socially responsible reporter-reformer. Perhaps most surprising to me in my own process of research was the discovery that Roosevelt's chosen successor in the White House, William Howard Taft, was a far more sympathetic, if flawed, figure than I had realized. Scholarship has long focused on the rift in the relations between the two men during the bitter 1912 election fight, ignoring their career-long mutually beneficial friendship. Throughout the Roosevelt administration, Taft functioned, in Roosevelt's own estimation, as the central figure in his cabinet. Because it was seen as undignified for a sitting president to campaign on his own behalf, Taft served as the chief surrogate during Roosevelt's 1904 presidential race, the most demanded speaker on the circuit to explain and justify the president's positions. In an era when presidents routinely spent long periods away from Washington, crisscrossing the country on whistle-stop tours or simply vacationing, it was Taft, the Secretary of War, not the Secretary of State or the Vice President, who was considered the acting president. Asked how things would be managed in his absence, Roosevelt blithely replied, "Oh, things will be all right. I have left Taft sitting on the lid." Long before Taft's 1908 election, Roosevelt had disclosed his passionate wish that Taft be his successor. There was no man in the country, he believed, better suited to be president. No man he trusted more to carry out his legacy of active moral leadership and progressive reform. Yet, left alone at the helm when Roosevelt embarked on a year-long African expedition, Taft questioned whether he was suited for the office. For all of Taft's admirable qualities and intentions to codify and expand upon Roosevelt's progressive legacy, he ultimately failed as a public leader, a failure that underscores the pivotal importance of the bully pulpit in presidential leadership. From the start of his administration, Taft's relationship with journalists was uneasy. He was never able to seek the counsel they offered, nor harness the press corps to broadcast a coherent narrative concerning his legislative goals. Even Taft's substantial accomplishments never received public acknowledgement. As a former judge, Taft assumed that once he had made a decision, his reasoning would be self-evident. Eventually, he recognized the handicap of his inability to engage and utilize the press as his predecessor had done. "I am not constituted as Mr. Roosevelt is," Taft explained to William Allen White. "It is a difference in temperament. He talked with correspondents a great deal. His heart was generally on his sleeve, and he must communicate his feelings. I find myself unable to do so. After I've made a definite statement, I have to let it go at that, until the time for action arises." Finally, my own process of discovery led me to the realization that the story I wanted to tell had three interwoven strands. One was the story of Theodore Roosevelt, whose crusade to expand the role of government in national life required the transformation of the presidency itself. The next strand was the story of William Howard Taft, whose talents and skills played a more significant role in the Roosevelt administration than is generally understood. When Taft attained the presidency, however, he found himself at sea, in large part because he was temperamentally unsuited to make use of the story's third strand, the bully pulpit that had provided the key to his predecessor's success. As S.S. McClure well understood, the vitality of democracy depends on popular knowledge of complex questions. At the height of McClure's magazine, observed the philosopher William James, the investigative journalists McClure had assembled and their counterparts in other leading magazines had embarked on nothing less than the mission of raising the tone of democracy, exerting an elevating influence on public sentiment. It is my greatest hope that the story that follows will guide readers through their own process of discovery toward a better understanding of what it takes to summon the public to take the actions necessary to bring our country closer to its ancient ideals. "There is no one left," McClure exhorted his readers as he cast about for a remedy to America's woes at the turn of the 20th century. "None but all of us." Doris Kearns Goodwin, September 2013. Chapter 1. The Hunter Returns. "Roosevelt is coming home! Hooray!" Exultant headlines in mid-June 1910 trumpeted the daily progress of the Kaiserin, the luxury liner returning the former President Theodore Roosevelt to American shores after his year's safari in Africa. Despite popularity unrivaled since Abraham Lincoln, Roosevelt, true to his word, had declined to run for a third term after completing 7.5 years in office. His tenure had stretched from William McKinley's assassination in September 1901 to March 4, 1909, when his own elected term came to an end. Flush from his November 1904 election triumph, he had stunned the political world with his announcement that he would not run for president again, citing the wise custom which limits the president to 2 terms. Later, he reportedly told a friend that he would willingly cut off his hand at the wrist if he could take his pledge back. Roosevelt had loved being president, the greatest office in the world. He had relished every hour of every day. Indeed, fearing the dull thud he would experience upon returning to private life, he had devised the perfect solution to break his fall. Within 3 weeks of the inauguration of his successor, William Howard Taft, he had embarked on his great African adventure, plunging into the most impenetrable spot on the globe. For months, Roosevelt's friends had been preparing an elaborate reception to celebrate his arrival in New York. When the Colonel, as Roosevelt preferred to be called, first heard of the extravagant plans devised for his welcome, he was troubled, fearing that the public response would not match such lofty expectations. "Even at this moment, I should certainly put an instant stop to all the proceedings if I felt they were being merely worked up and there was not a real desire of at least a great many people to greet me," he wrote one of the organizers in March. "My political career is ended," he told Lawrence Abbott of the Outlook, who had come to meet him in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, when he first emerged from the jungle. "No man in American public life has ever reached the crest of the wave as I appear to have done, without the waves breaking and engulfing him." Anxiety that his star had dimmed, that the public's devotion had dwindled, proved wildly off the mark. While he had initially planned to return directly from Khartoum, Roosevelt had received so many invitations to visit the reigning European sovereigns that he first embarked on a 6-week tour of Italy, Austria, Hungary, France, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Norway, Germany, and England. Kings and queens greeted him as an equal. Universities bestowed upon him their highest degrees, and the German Kaiser treated him as an intimate friend. Every city, town, and village received him with a frenzied enthusiasm that stunned the most sophisticated observers. People gathered at railway stations, in schoolhouses, and in the village streets, one journalist observed. They showered his carriage with flowers, thronged windows of tenement houses, and greeted him with "Viva, viva, viva Roosevelt!" Newspapers in the United States celebrated Roosevelt's triumphant procession through the old world, sensing in his unparalleled reception a tribute to America's newfound position of power. No foreign ruler or man of eminence could have aroused more universal attention, received a warmer welcome, or achieved greater popularity among every class of society, the New York Times crowed. "I don't suppose there was ever such a reception as that being given Theodore in Europe," Taft wistfully told his military aide, Captain Archie Butt. "It illustrates how his personality has swept over the world, such that even small villages, which one would hardly think had ever heard of the United States, should seem to know all about the man." The stories of Roosevelt's royal progress through Europe bolstered the efforts of his friends to ensure, in Taft's words, "as great a demonstration of welcome from his countrymen as any American ever received." In the week preceding his arrival in America, tens of thousands of visitors from all over the country had descended upon New York, lending the city's hotels and streets a holiday appearance. Inbound trains carried a cast of characters as diversely typical of the American people as Mr. Roosevelt himself. Conservationists and cowboys, capitalists and socialists, insurgents and regulars, churchmen and sportsmen, native-born and aliens. More than 200 vessels, including 5 destroyers, 6 revenue cutters, and dozens of excursion steamboats, tugs, and ferryboats, all decked with colorful flags and pennants, had sailed into the harbor to take part in an extravagant naval display. An army of construction workers labored to complete the speaker's platform and grandstand seating at Battery Park, where Roosevelt would address an overflow crowd of invited guests. Businesses had given their workers a half holiday so they could join in the festivities. Flags floated everywhere, an Ohio newspaper reported. Pictures of Roosevelt were hung in thousands of windows along the line of march. Buildings were draped with bunting. The night before the big day, a dragnet was set to arrest known pickpockets. 5,000 police and dozens of surgeons and nurses were called in for special duty. The United States of America at the present moment simulates quite the attitude of the small boy who can't go to sleep Christmas Eve for thinking of the next day, the Atlanta Constitution suggested. And the colonel, returning as rapidly as a lusty steamship can plow the waves, is the next day. It is a remarkable tribute to the man's personality that virtually every element of citizenship in the country should be more or less on tiptoes in excitement of anticipation. Shortly after 7 a.m. on June 18th, as the bright rising sun burned through the mists, Theodore Roosevelt, as jubilant with anticipation as his country, stood on the bridge of the Kaiserin as the vessel headed into New York Harbor. Edith, his handsome 48-year-old wife, stood beside him. She had journeyed halfway around the world to join him in Khartoum at the end of his long African expedition. Edith had found their year-long parting, the longest in their 23 years of marriage, almost unbearable. "If it were not for the children here, I would not have the nervous strength to live through these endless months of separation from father," she wrote her son, Kermit, after Theodore had been gone only 2 weeks. "When I am alone and let myself think, I am done for." Edith was no stranger to the anxiety of being apart from the man for whom she would do anything in the world. They had been intimate childhood friends, growing up together in New York's Union Square neighborhood. She had joined Teddy, as he was then called, and his younger sister Corinne in a private schoolroom arranged at the Roosevelt Mansion. Even as children, they missed each other when apart. As Teddy was leaving with his family on a grand tour of Europe when he was 11 years old, he broke down in tears at the thought of leaving 8-year-old Edith behind. She proved his most faithful correspondent over the long course of the trip. She had been a regular guest at Tranquility, the Roosevelt's summer home on Long Island, where they sailed together in the bay, rode horseback along the trails, and shared a growing passion for literature. As adolescents, they were dancing partners at cotillions and constant companions on the social scene. Roosevelt proudly noted that his freshman college classmates at Harvard considered Edith and her friend Annie Murray the prettiest girls they had met when they visited him in New York during Christmas vacation. In the summer of 1878, after his sophomore year, however, the young couple had a mysterious falling out at Tranquility. One day, Roosevelt later wrote, there came a break during a late afternoon rendezvous at the estate's summer house. The conflict that erupted, Roosevelt admitted, ended his very intimate relations with Edith. Though neither one would ever say what had happened, Roosevelt cryptically noted to his sister Anna that both of us had, and I suppose have, tempers that were far from being of the best. The intimacy that Edith had cherished for nearly two decades seemed lost forever the following October, when Roosevelt met Alice Hathaway Lee. The beautiful, enchanting daughter of a wealthy Boston businessman, Alice lived in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, not far from Cambridge. The young Harvard junior fell in love with his whole heart and soul. 4 months after his graduation in 1880, they were married. Then, in 1884, only 2 days after giving birth to their only child, Alice died. A year later, Theodore resumed his friendship with Edith, and the year following, they were married. As time passed, Edith's meticulous and thoughtful nature made her an exemplary partner for Theodore. I do not think my eyes are blinded by affection, the president told a friend, when I say that she has combined to a degree I have never seen in any other woman the power of being the best of wives and mothers, the wisest manager of the household, and at the same time the ideal great lady and mistress of the White House. Their boisterous family eventually included 6 children. 3 of the 6 were standing next to their parents on the bridge of the ocean liner. 20-year-old Kermit, who had accompanied his father to Africa, 18-year-old Ethel, and 26-year-old Alice, the child born to his first wife. The girls had joined their parents in Europe. Along the rails of the 4 upper decks, their fellow passengers, some 3,000 in all, formed a colorful pageant as they waved their handkerchiefs and cheered. While wireless telegrams on board the ship had alerted Roosevelt to some of the day's planned activities, he was surprised to learn that President Taft had assigned the massive battleship South Carolina as his official escort. By George, that's one of my ships! Doesn't she look good? An overwhelmed Roosevelt exclaimed when he saw her gray bulk pulling near. Flags were broken out from stem to stern in the ceremony of dressing the ship, reported the Boston Globe, while a puff from the muzzle of an 8-pounder signaled the start of a 21-gun salute, the highest ceremonial honor generally reserved for heads of state. Sailors clad in blue lined the decks of the warship as the scarlet-uniformed Marine band played the Star-Spangled Banner. The cannon roar of the South Carolina was followed by the rhythmic volley of salutes and whistles from the dozen or more additional naval ships in the bay. President Taft had clearly gone to great lengths, Captain Butt proudly noted, to add dignity to the welcome and to extend a warm personal greeting to his predecessor. From the deck, Roosevelt spotted the tugboat carrying the reporters whose eyewitness accounts of the spectacular scene would dominate the news the following day. As he leaned over the rail and vigorously waved his top hat back and forth to them, they stood and cheered. To each familiar face, he nodded his head and smiled broadly, displaying his famous teeth, which appeared just as prominent and just as white and perfect as when he went away. Then, recognizing the photographer's need to snap his picture, he stopped his hectic motions and stood perfectly still. During his presidency, Roosevelt's physical vigor and mental curiosity had made the White House a hive of activity and interest. His love of the hurly-burly that enchanted reporters and their readers was best captured by British Viscount John Morley, who claimed that he had seen 2 tremendous works of nature in America, the Niagara Falls and Mr. Roosevelt. One magazine writer marveled at his prodigious stream of guests. Pugilists, college presidents, professional wrestlers, Greek scholars, baseball teams, big game hunters, sociologists, press agents, authors, actors, rough riders, bad men and gunfighters from the West, wolf catchers, photographers, guides, bear hunters, artists, labor leaders. When he left for Africa, the noise and excitement vanished. Little wonder that the members of the press were thrilled to see him return. Shortly after the Kaiserin dropped anchor at quarantine, the revenue cutter Manhattan pulled alongside her, carrying the Roosevelt's youngest sons, 16-year-old Archie and 12-year-old Quentin, both of whom had remained at home. Their oldest son, 22-year-old Theodore Jr., set to marry Eleanor Alexander the following Monday, joined the group along with an assortment of family members, including Roosevelt's sisters Anna and Corinne, his son-in-law, Congressman Nicholas Longworth, his niece, Eleanor Roosevelt, and her husband, Franklin. While Edith anxiously sought a glimpse of the children she had not seen for more than 2 months, Roosevelt busily shook hands with each of the officers, sailors, and engineers of the ship. "Come here, Theodore, and see your children," Edith called out. "They are of far greater importance than politics or anything else." Roosevelt searched the promenade deck of the Manhattan, reported the Chicago Tribune, until his eyes rested on the round face of his youngest boy, Quentin, who was dancing up and down on the deck impatient to be recognized, telling all who would listen that he would be the one to kiss Pop first. At the sight of the lively child, the colonel spread his arms out as if he would undertake a long-distance embrace, and smiled broadly as he nodded to each of his relatives in turn. When Roosevelt stepped onto the crimson-covered gangplank for his transfer to the Manhattan, pandemonium broke loose. The ship's band played America, the New York Times reported, and there came from the river craft, yachts, and ships nearby a volley of cheers that lasted for fully 5 minutes. Bugles blared, whistles shrieked, and everywhere flags waved, hats were tossed into the air, and cries of welcome were heard. Approaching the deck where his children were jumping in anticipation, Roosevelt executed a flying leap, and with the exuberance and spirit of a schoolboy, he took up Quentin and Archie in his arms and gave them resounding smacks. He greeted his son Theodore with a hearty slap on the back, kissed his sisters, and then proceeded to shake hands with every crew member. Around 9 a.m., the Androscoggin, carrying Cornelius Vanderbilt, the chairman of the reception, and 200 distinguished guests, came alongside the Manhattan. As Roosevelt made the transfer to the official welcoming vessel, he asked that everyone form a line so that he could greet each individual personally, and then went at the task of shaking hands with such high spirits, delivering for each person such an explosive word of welcome, that what might have been a duty for another politician became an act of joy. "I'm so glad to see you," he greeted each person in turn. The New York Times reporter noted the "so" went off like a firecracker. The smile backed it up in a radiation of energy, and the hearty grip of the hand that came down upon its respondent with a bang emphasized again the exact meaning of the words. When Roosevelt grasped the hand of Joe Murray, the savvy political boss who had first nominated him for the state legislature years before, it must have seemed as if his public life had come full circle. "This takes me back 29 years, he said, "to the old 21st Assembly District when I was getting a start in politics." Earlier, he had warmly welcomed Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, his closest friend for more than a quarter of a century, and Archie Butt, who had served as his devoted military aide before taking up the same position with President Taft. Jacob Riis, the Danish immigrant whose book How the Other Half Lives had greatly influenced Roosevelt when he was police commissioner of New York City, received a fraternal welcome and the broadest of smiles. Roosevelt clasped him with both hands, exclaiming, "Oh, Jake, I've got so much to tell you." His face grew somber as he glimpsed Beverly Robinson, who conjured memories of McKinley's assassination. "This boy was with me on top of Mount Mary," he mused, "when the sudden news came that I had become president." Nothing, however, could dampen his innate joviality for more than a moment. "Why, hello, Stimson, old sugar trust," he laughed, his eyes twinkling as he approached Henry Stimson, the government's special counsel in the famous trust case. "Oh, friend, this is good. I can't tell you how I feel," he confided to Frank Tyree, the Secret Service man who had protected him loyally for years. On and on he went, his personal greetings for all interspersed with expressions of outright delight. "Fine, fine. Oh, it's simply great. George, this is bully." When Vanderbilt suggested it was time to go up to the bridge to acknowledge the thousands of people massed solidly on both the New Jersey and the Manhattan sides of the river, Roosevelt hesitated. "But here are the reporters," he said, turning to the members of the press, busily taking down his words. "I want to shake hands with them." Indeed, at every stop during the long day, he made sure to deliver a special welcome to the members of the press. "Boys, I am glad," emphasis on the glad, "to see you. It does me good to see you, boys. I am glad to be back." Clearly that pleasure was reciprocated. "We're mighty glad to have you back," shouted one exuberant reporter. Throughout his presidency, Roosevelt had enjoyed an unusually close relationship with the press, particularly with the members of McClure's magazine, the celebrated monthly publication that had launched the muckraking movement with its wildly popular exposés of monopolies, political bosses, unsafe railroads, and fraudulent medicines. The McClure's team, considered by many to be the most brilliant gathering of journalists ever assembled, included Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Stanyard Baker, and William Allen White. All of them were household names at the time. All were captivated by Theodore Roosevelt. Reporters present at the festivities remarked how hale and hearty the 51-year-old Roosevelt looked, tanned and extremely fit. "It is true that the mustache, once brown, has grown grayer, but the strong face is not furrowed with deep wrinkles, and the crow's feet have not changed the expression which is habitual to the man who is in robust health and has a joy in living." After the long African expedition, he displayed a leaner physique, but overall he seemed the same bubbling, explosively exuberant American as when he left. Archie Butt, however, detected something different, though at first he could not put his finger on it. After talking with Lodge, they speculated that as a citizen of the world, not simply an American, Roosevelt had developed an enlarged personality with a mental scope more encompassing. At Battery Park, where the Androscoggin was due to dock around 11 a.m., an immense crowd had gathered since early morning, straining for sight of the ship that would bring Roosevelt onto American soil. A reporter captured this mood of anticipation in his story of a stevedore who, in the midst of unloading cargo of another ship, laid aside his hook in hopes of glimpsing Roosevelt. His foreman shouted at him, "You come back here or I'll dock you an hour." The stevedore, undaunted, retorted, "Dock me a week. I'm going to have a look at Teddy." "There he is," came the cry, soon confirmed as a beaming Roosevelt came ashore to a rendition of Home Sweet Home by the 71st Regimental Band. The uplifted cheers that greeted the man of the hour as he disembarked were said to exceed the echoing boom of saluting cannon and the strident blast of steam whistles. Straight away, Roosevelt headed from the pier to the speaker's platform. He was in the midst of shaking hands with cabinet members, senators and congressmen, governors and mayors, when his daughter Alice cried, "Turn around, Father, and look at the crowd." Outspread before him was one vast expanse of human countenances, all upturned to him, all waiting for him. Beyond the 600 seated guests, 3,500 people stood within the roped enclosure, and beyond them, unnumbered thousands on the plaza. Still more crammed together on the surrounding streets. It was estimated that at least 100,000 people had come to Battery Park, undeterred by the crushing throngs and the oppressive heat and humidity. From a ninth-floor window of the nearby Washington building, a life-size teddy bear, belted with a green sash, was suspended. A large white banner bearing Roosevelt's favorite word, "delighted," was displayed on the Whitehall building, where, from street level to skyline, every window was open and every sill held as many stenographers and office boys and bosses as the sills could accommodate. Clearly, this was not a day for work. "Is there a stenographer here?" Roosevelt asked as he prepared to speak. Assured that one was present, he began, his voice filled with emotion. "No man could receive such a greeting without being made to feel very proud and humble. I have been away a year and a quarter from America, and I have seen strange and interesting things alike in the heart of the wilderness and in the capitals of the mightiest and most highly polished civilized nations. Nonetheless," he assured the crowd, I am more glad than I can say to get home, back in my own country, back among the people I love. And I am ready and eager to do my part, so far as I am able, in helping to solve problems which must be solved. This is the duty of every citizen, but it is peculiarly my duty. For any man who has ever been honored by being made President of the United States is thereby forever after rendered the debtor of the American people. For those who wondered whether Roosevelt would remain active in public life, his brief but eloquent remarks were telling. The address at Battery Park only served to set off the real celebration. A 5-mile parade up Broadway to 59th and 5th followed, with an estimated 1 million spectators lining the streets. The sidewalks on both sides of Broadway were jammed with people from curb to building fronts, the Chicago Tribune noted. There were people in all the windows, people on the housetops, and people banked up in the side streets. As Roosevelt took his place in the open carriage leading the procession, an additional surprise lay in store for him. 150 members of his Rough Rider unit, whom he had led so brilliantly in the Spanish-American War, appeared on horseback to serve as his escort of honor. Beyond the Rough Riders, there were 2,000 additional veterans from that same war who had come to participate in the celebration. The demonstration was incomparably the largest affair of its kind on record, the Washington, D.C. Evening Star claimed. Characteristic of the man himself, the man of superlatives, and of intense moods. Placards with friendly inscriptions, familiar cartoons, and exhortations for Roosevelt to once again run for the presidency in 1912 hung in shop windows all along the way. At 310 Broadway, an immense teddy bear stared down an enormous stuffed African lion. At Scribner's, a 10-foot-high portrait of the colonel in full hunting gear graced the front of the building. Peddlers were everywhere. You could not move a step, one reporter observed, without having shoved in your face a remarkable assortment of teddy souvenirs. There were jungle hats with ribbons bearing the word "delighted." There were Roosevelt medals, teddy's teeth in celluloid, miniature teddy bears, gorgeous flags on canes with a picture of the Rough Rider, buttons, pins, and many other reminders of the colonel's career. Even along Wall Street, where it was jokingly predicted black crepe would signal Roosevelt's return, given his storied fights with the malefactors of great wealth, flags waved and colored streamers were tossed from upper windows. "Teddy! Teddy! Bully for you, Teddy!" the crowd yelled, and he responded with unconcealed delight to the gleeful chants. One could see that he enjoyed every moment of the triumphal progress, the New York Times reported. And those who cheered, cheered the louder when they saw how their cheers delighted him. Near the end of the route, a reporter shouted, "Are you tired?" His answer was clear and firm despite the long day, the hot sun, and the perspiration dripping down his face. "Not a bit." Around 1 p.m., when the parade finally concluded at the 59th Street Plaza, Roosevelt, with tears in his eyes, flashed his dazzling smile and headed toward a private residence for a family lunch. No sooner had the colonel reached his destination than a frightening storm began. Lightning, thunder, and ferocious winds accompanied a heavy downpour. Uprooted trees littered the ground with fallen limbs. In all, 17 lives were lost. It seemed the sky had stayed peaceful and blue only for the sun-splashed hours of the celebration for Roosevelt. Everyone began talking about Roosevelt luck, Captain Butt observed. While the pelting rain continued, Roosevelt relaxed in the Fifth Avenue home belonging to the grandfather of his son's fiancée, and enjoyed a festive meal of chicken and cream sauce with rice while catching up on the news of the day. In the late afternoon, he boarded a special train for his hometown of Oyster Bay, Long Island. Once again, the Roosevelt luck came into play. The severe rainstorm miraculously ceased just as his train pulled in. He was met by the whole town, complete with a 500-member children's choir, a display of devotion that nearly swept the former president from his feet as he stepped to the ground. Walking beneath triumphal arches, constructed by his neighbors, Roosevelt reached a nearby ballpark where grandstands had been raised to seat 3,000 people. There he spoke movingly of what it meant to be home once more. To live among you again, as I have for the last 40 years. Reporters who had followed Roosevelt since he began shaking hands on the Kaiserin that morning marveled at the energy with which he continued to grasp the hands of his neighbors, finding something personal to say to one and all, without revealing the slightest trace of fatigue in voice or manner. In their lengthy coverage of the historic day, the press corps brought to light scores of colorful anecdotes. The story they failed to get, however, was the story they wanted above all. Roosevelt's response to the major political issue of the day, the growing disenchantment of progressive Republicans with the leadership of President Taft. As his second term neared its end, Roosevelt had handpicked from his cabinet the trusted friend he desired to succeed him, William Howard Taft. The two men had first met in their early 30s, when Roosevelt headed the Civil Service Commission and Taft was Solicitor General. "We lived in the same part of Washington," Taft recalled. "Our wives knew each other well, and some of our children were born about the same time." Over the years, this friendship had deepened, becoming what Taft described as one of close and sweet intimacy. During his first presidential term, Roosevelt had invited Taft, then Governor General of the newly acquired Philippine Islands, to serve as his Secretary of War. Initially reluctant to leave a post to which his talents were ideally suited, Taft had finally been persuaded to join his old friend's administration as the foremost member of his cabinet, his daily counselor and advisor in all the great questions that might confront them. Roosevelt had thrown all his inexhaustible energy behind the drive to make Taft president. "I am quite as nervous about your campaign as I should be if it were my own," he had told Taft. He had edited Taft's speeches, relayed a constant stream of advice, and corralled his own immense block of supporters behind Taft's candidacy. When Taft was elected, Roosevelt reveled in the victory, both delighted for a beloved friend and confident that America had chosen the man best suited to execute the progressive goals Roosevelt had championed, to distribute the nation's wealth more equitably, regulate the giant corporations and railroads, strengthen the rights of labor, and protect the country's natural resources from private exploitation. At the start of Roosevelt's presidency, big business had been in the saddle. While the country prospered as never before, little attention had been paid to those who had been left behind in immigrant slums, unsafe mines, and squalid factories. While voices had been raised to protest the increasing concentration of corporate wealth and the growing gap between rich and poor, the reigning doctrine of laissez-faire precluded collective action to ameliorate social conditions. Under the banner of Roosevelt's Square Deal, the country had awakened to the need for government action to allay the problems caused by industrialization, an awakening spurred in large part by the dramatic exposés of a talented group of investigative journalists he famously labeled muckrakers. By the end of Roosevelt's tenure, much had been accomplished. The moribund 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act had been revived. Vast acres of land had been protected from exploitation, and railroads had been prevented from continuing long-standing abuses. Congress had passed workmen's compensation, a pure food and drug law, and a meat inspection act. Nevertheless, much remained to be done. Roosevelt's legacy would depend upon the actions of his chosen successor, William Howard Taft. "Taft is as fine a fellow as ever sat in the president's chair," Roosevelt told a friend shortly after the election, "and I cannot express the measureless content that comes over me as I think that the work in which I have so much believed will be carried on by him." While he was abroad, however, Roosevelt had received numerous disturbing communications from his progressive friends. Word that his closest ally in the conservation movement, Chief Forester Gifford Pinchot, had been removed by Taft, left Roosevelt dumbfounded. "I do not know any man in public life who has rendered quite the service you have rendered," he wrote to Pinchot, "and it seems to be absolutely impossible that there can be any truth in this statement." When the news was confirmed, he had asked Pinchot to meet him in Europe in order to hear his first-hand account. Pinchot had arrived with a number of letters from fellow progressives, all expressing a belief that Taft had aligned himself with old-line conservatives on Capitol Hill and was gradually compromising Roosevelt's hard-won advances. Roosevelt found it difficult to believe he had so misjudged the character and convictions of his old friend, William Howard Taft. On his final day in Europe, he had confided his puzzlement to Sir Edward Grey, as the two outdoorsmen tramped through the New Forest of southern England in pursuit of the song or sight of several English birds Roosevelt had only read about. Roosevelt's spirit was much troubled by what was happening in his own country since he left office, Grey recalled. He spoke of Taft and of their work together with very live affection, and he wished Taft to succeed him, had supported him, made way for him. How could he now break with Taft and attack him? Yet the concerted voice of his progressive friends was urging him to do precisely that. All through the spring, as the date of his return approached, one question had dominated political discourse and speculation. What will Mr. Roosevelt do? Which side would he take in the intensifying struggle that was dividing the Republican Party between the old-line conservatives and a steadily growing number of insurgents, as the progressive faction was then known? Aware that anything he said would be construed as hurtful or helpful to one side or the other, Roosevelt determined to remain silent on all political matters until he could more fully absorb and analyze the situation. "There's one thing I want, and that is absolute privacy," he told reporters as the day's celebration came to an end. "I want to close up like a native oyster. I'm glad to have you all here, but I have nothing to say." The weeks preceding Roosevelt's homecoming had been especially difficult for President Taft. "He looks haggard and careworn," Captain Butt told his sister-in-law Clara. His characteristic ruddy complexion had faded to a sickly pale. His weight had ballooned to 320 pounds, and his jovial temperament had turned mournful. It is hard on any man to see the eyes of everyone turn to another person as the eyes of the entire country are turning to Roosevelt, Butt speculated. Nonetheless, Butt acknowledged that Taft's low spirits had little to do with jealousy. Never once had he heard Taft murmur against the fate that kept him, a man of tremendous personality himself, in the shadow of his predecessor. "He is so broad as to show no resentment of his secondary role," Butt marveled. Rather, Taft's anxiety stemmed, he thought, from the fact that he loves Theodore Roosevelt, and the specter of a potential rupture in their friendship was causing great emotional distress. No shadow of such troubles was in evidence when Taft's presidency began. "He is going to be greatly beloved as president," Roosevelt had predicted. "He has the most lovable personality I have ever come in contact with." A big man with a big heart, clear blue eyes, and a thoughtful nature, Taft was portrayed as America incarnate, sham-hating, hard-working, crackling with jokes upon himself, lacking in pomp but never in dignity, a great, boyish, wholesome, dauntless, shrewd, sincere, kindly gentleman. The time had come, even Roosevelt's most ardent admirers agreed, for a different kind of leader, a quieter, less controversial figure. Roosevelt, with his fiery temperament, inexhaustible supply of arresting quips and demagogic appeals, had given powerful voice to the progressive movement. Now, Roosevelt's journalist friend William Allen White argued, the country needed a man who could finish the things Roosevelt had begun, who could work with Congress to consolidate the imperfect statutes and executive orders generated in the tumultuous previous years. Although Taft would say little, White acknowledged, he would do much. His mind would not, like Roosevelt's, move by flashes or whims or sudden impulses, another journalist wrote, but rather with steady efficiency, in straight lines, and by long, logical habit. Taft agreed with this assessment of the situation he faced. He likened Roosevelt's administration to a great crusade that had aroused the people to the need for greater federal regulation of the economy. Now it was the work of his administration to make these expanded powers permanent in the form of law. In contrast to Roosevelt, a career politician whose intense desire to reach practical results had led him occasionally to chafe under the restraint of legal methods, Taft had trained as a lawyer and a judge, disciplines that had instilled the necessity for legal method. Roosevelt had ended his presidency in an ugly fight with a Congress he had sought to bypass through a direct appeal to the public. With a very different yet complementary temperament, Taft insisted that he must work with the tools and the men at hand. It was his misfortune to take office at a time marked by a bitter rift within the Republican Party, when progressives viewed compromise with conservatives as treachery. Taft had not openly sought the presidency. Since his appointment as a Superior Court judge at the age of 29, he had aspired to one day become Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He had moved swiftly up the judicial ladder, becoming Solicitor General at age 32, and a Federal Circuit Judge at 34. When President McKinley asked him to go to the Philippines, it was with the implied promise that he would return to a Supreme Court appointment. When Roosevelt became president, he honored his predecessor's promise, twice offering Taft a position on the Supreme Court. With great reluctance, Taft had declined both opportunities. In the first instance, he felt he could not leave his work in the Philippines unfinished. In the second, his wife and closest advisor, Nellie, persuaded him not to bury himself on the court at the very moment when, as Secretary of War, he was being touted throughout the country as Roosevelt's most likely successor. Indeed, were it not for his wife's White House dreams, Taft would likely never have agreed to a presidential run. Taft found little joy in campaigning for the presidency in 1908. He had great misgivings about every speech he was forced to make. For months, the thought of his acceptance speech loomed over him like a nightmare. He feared that his efforts to forge a middle ground on issues would make many people mad. Unlike Roosevelt, who regularly perused articles about himself and found pleasure in responding to critics, Taft acknowledged that negative press left him very, very discouraged. After a while, despite Nellie's urgings, he refused to read unfavorable articles altogether. His speeches, Nellie warned, tended to be much too long. "But I am made this way, and I can do no other," he told her. "That is the kind of an old slow coach you married." In the end, with his campaign manager, as he called Nellie, by his side to edit his speeches and offer advice, comfort, and encouragement, he won a magnificent victory over William Jennings Bryan. Taft took office with commingled exhilaration and trepidation. "I pinch myself every little while to make myself realize that it is all true," he told a friend. "If I were now presiding in the Supreme Court of the United States as Chief Justice, I should feel entirely at home. But with the troubles of selecting a cabinet and the difficulties in respect to the revision of the tariff, I feel just a bit like a fish out of water." More than a year later, such misgivings had not subsided. When asked if he liked being president, he replied that he would rather be Chief Justice, for the quieter life on the court would prove more in keeping with my temperament. "However," he reflected, "when taken into consideration that I go into history as a president, and my children and my children's children are the better placed on account of that fact, I am inclined to think that to be president well compensates one for all the trials and criticisms he has to bear and undergo." Taft well knew how fortunate he was to have a natural politician in his devoted and intelligent wife, one whose superb judgment and political acumen could help him overcome the obstacles that just at present seem formidable. They had been partners from the earliest days of their married life in Cincinnati. Like Edith and Theodore, Nellie and Will had grown up together in the same city. Their sisters had been schoolmates, and their fathers, Nellie wrote, had practiced law at the same bar for more than 40 years. Nellie and Will had been friends for 6 years when their relationship began to deepen into love. Young Nellie was an unconventional woman. From early adolescence, she craved a more expansive life. She liked to smoke, drink beer, and play cards for money. She was an avid reader with a passion for classical music, a talented writer, and a dedicated teacher. In her early 20s, she had organized a weekly salon with Will and his brother Horace among the regular participants. Every Saturday night, their circle of six or seven friends presented essays and discussed literature and national politics with such high feeling and enthusiasm, Nellie recalled, that the history of the Salon became the history of our lives during that period. The more time he spent with Nellie, Will told his father, the deeper grew my respect for her, the warmer my friendship, until it unconsciously ripened into a feeling that she was indispensable to my happiness. Her eagerness for knowledge of all kinds puts me to shame. Her capacity for work is wonderful. For her part, Nellie found in Will a husband who adored her and highly valued her intelligence. Their union provided a channel for her to pursue her intense ambition to accomplish something vital in life. Will also proved a loving father for their three children, Robert, Helen, and Charlie, who were 18, 16, and 11 when Taft became president. Throughout their marriage, Taft looked to Nellie as a merciless but loving critic, depending on her advice at every critical juncture. They labored together over his speeches and discussed political strategy in a manner, one observer recalled, much like two men who are intimate chums. Their partnership gave Taft confidence that he would learn to navigate the uncharted waters of the presidency. The New York Times predicted that with Nellie Taft as First Lady, the Taft administration will be brilliant beyond any similar period in America's social history. Over the years, she had established a sterling reputation as a Democratic hostess, opening her doors to people from all backgrounds. In the Philippines, she had stunned the conservative military establishment by rejecting their strict segregation of whites and native Filipinos, instead insisting upon complete racial equality at the governor's palace. As First Lady, she brought the same egalitarian ethos to her position. She spoke out against the unhealthy working conditions of government employees and embarked upon several civic projects. She helped design a beautiful public park along the tidal basin, where concerts could be held every week during the summer months, and made arrangements to bring the same flowering cherry trees she had admired in Japan to the nation's capital. Nellie Taft was swiftly becoming one of the most respected and powerful first ladies in history. Then, only 10 weeks after the inauguration, terrible misfortune shattered these auspicious beginnings. On board the presidential yacht with her husband and some guests, Nellie suffered a devastating stroke that left her temporarily paralyzed and unable to speak. At the sight of his half-conscious wife, only 47 years old, Taft turned deathly pale. Taft's great soul, Archie Butt emphasized, was wrapped in darkness. Although Nellie gradually recovered the ability to walk, she would continue to struggle with her speech for the rest of her life. A year after Nellie's stroke, shortly before Roosevelt was due to return to America, Taft sent him a plaintive handwritten letter weighing his accomplishments and failures as president. "I have had a hard time," he confided. "I do not know that I have had harder luck than other presidents, but I do know that thus far I have succeeded far less than have others. I have been conscientiously trying to carry out your policies, but my method of doing so has not worked smoothly." In closing, he told his old friend, "It would give me a great deal of pleasure if, after you get settled at Oyster Bay, you could come over to Washington and spend a few days at the White House." Taft had been tempted to go to New York and personally welcome Roosevelt home. According to one report in the Indianapolis Star, his advisors had suggested that this demonstration of amity would be appreciated by Colonel Roosevelt and would do more than anything else to drive away the suspicion that seems to have gained ground that the relations between the chief executive and his predecessor are strained. Upon reflection, however, Taft concluded that it would diminish the status of the presidential office if he were to race down to the gangplank to be the first to shake hands with the former president. He explained to his military aide that he was charged with the dignity of the executive and was determined to say nothing that would put a momentary slight even on that great office. No matter how much he would rather be Will welcoming his friend Theodore, he was now President Taft. "I think, moreover, that Roosevelt will appreciate this feeling in me," he concluded, "and would be the first one to resent the slightest subordination of the office of president to any man." Instead, he planned a journey of his own that day, a train trip to Villanova, Pennsylvania, to deliver the commencement address at the Catholic University, followed by a visit to the small town of Westchester, and a second commencement address at a celebrated black institution, Lincoln University. When you are being hammered, Taft explained, not only by the press, but by members of your own party in Washington, and one feels there isn't anything quite right that he can do, the pleasure of going out into the country, of going into a city that hasn't seen a president for 20 years, and then makes a fuss over him to prove to him that there is somebody that doesn't know of his defects, is a pleasure I don't like to forego. He boarded the train at Union Station in Washington for a departure to Philadelphia at 7 a.m., the very hour at which Roosevelt's ocean liner reached New York. Before the train left, it was noted that he read with deep interest the latest news of the homecoming of Colonel Roosevelt. Arriving at Philadelphia shortly before 10:30, he was taken by a special locomotive to Villanova, where he was met by a delegation of over 500 professors and students. The college had arranged to bring all the members of the faculty, the entire student body, and all the townspeople that could get to the station in traps, autos, and on foot. As the president stepped from the locomotive, the Villanova band played Hail to the Chief, and the college boys let out one concentrated, prolonged, and tremendous yell. Charmed by the rousing welcome, Taft broke into a beaming smile. The entire visit to Villanova proved a gratifying relief from the besieging trials of the presidency. The commencement exercises took place in the college auditorium, gaily decorated with bunting and flags. Since the auditorium held only 2,500 invited guests, arrangements had been made for Taft to deliver his address outside, so that an overflow crowd of 5,000 people who had been gathering on the ground since early morning might hear him. The Roosevelt luck that graced the former president's celebration in New York with sunny skies did not hold for Taft, however. The sky blackened with thunderclouds just as he was set to start his address, prompting a reluctant decision to speak indoors. Despite the sudden change, Taft's address was received with enthusiasm. He applauded the Augustinians' missionary work in the Philippines and spoke wistfully of his years as Governor General, perhaps the most fulfilling of his political career. An outburst of applause greeted every positive reference to the Catholic Church, and when he finished his speech, the entire audience rose in loud acclamation. With lifted spirits, Taft boarded a special train to Westchester, home to Republican Congressman Thomas S. Butler. Butler had remained loyal to Taft all through the difficult days of his presidency. Now, Taft graciously repaid him by making a flying visit to the little town to deliver two short speeches extolling his steadfast supporter. "He came to me at the beginning of my administration," Taft said of Butler, "and declared he was going to stand by me to the end. He probably didn't know how much that meant." The townspeople were thrilled to see the president. Banks, office buildings, residences, and the post office were a mass of colors, one correspondent wrote, while displayed on a number of buildings were the 10-foot-high letters T-A-F-T. The president continued on to the campus of Lincoln University, arriving just as a terrific electrical storm raged overhead. Undeterred, 2,000 people patiently stood on the grounds in the pouring rain without even the protection of umbrellas. "I thank you sincerely for coming out to greet me," he humbly told the cheering crowd. "I understand that it is to the President of the United States, and I accept it as such." In his well-received address, Taft referred to Booker T. Washington as one of the greatest men of the century, and called on the black community to develop its own educated leaders to help solve the nation's racial problems. Despite Taft's heartfelt reception all along his route, the press could not resist drawing comparisons between the outright jubilation that marked Roosevelt's sunlit homecoming on the seacoast and the decorous approval accorded the president in the rain-drenched interior. Furthermore, while Roosevelt seemed as fresh and buoyant at day's end as when he disembarked, Taft was travel-stained and exhausted when he boarded the train back to Washington. One reporter went so far as to portray the overweight Taft in a free state of perspiration, suffering from so much prickly heat that it pushes his clothes out from him, making it impossible for him to keep his shirt in place. On his way home, Taft read the afternoon newspaper accounts of Roosevelt's homecoming reception, doubtless taking note of the colonel's remark that he stood ready and eager to do his part in solving the country's ills. When the president reached the White House shortly before 10 o'clock, his weariness abruptly vanished with news that his bill to expand the federal government's power to prevent arbitrary increases in railroad rates had passed the Congress that day and was awaiting his signature. Even in the worst of times, when bombarded by criticism in insurgent newspapers for his willingness to deal with the conservative bloc in the Congress, Taft had retained an abiding faith that if he could secure legislation the country needed, the credit would take care of itself, ultimately. Now, with the passage of his railroad bill, he could allow himself a bit of optimism. In the previous session, he had secured a corporation tax bill, hailed as the first positive step toward the national supervision of great corporations, as well as an amendment to the Interstate Commerce Act that gave the commission, for the first time, the power to prevent stock watering. In addition to the railroad bill, two important progressive measures were about to receive his signature. The first confirmed presidential authority to withdraw millions of acres of land for conservation. The second, a postal savings bill, fought at every step by powerful interests, provided the poor a secure place to deposit their money. That very afternoon, in fact, the lead editorial in the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin suggested that Taft had unquestionably strengthened his position in the public esteem within the last 30 days, as the country was beginning to realize more clearly the essential force that lies behind his quiet, persistent methods. His policy throughout has been that of a resolute defender of the public interest, who preferred to work without parade or ostentation. As he went to sleep that night, Taft could take heart that Roosevelt, too, would recognize the necessity that led him to deal with the conservatives. He was working in his own unspectacular way to accomplish the progressive goals that both shared with equal fervor. That morning, he had dispatched Captain Butt to deliver a second handwritten letter to Roosevelt as he landed in New York. He warmly reiterated the invitation tendered to Roosevelt 3 weeks earlier to join him at the White House. Once reunited, despite the swirling tensions and innuendo, they might enjoy the camaraderie of the old days, when, as Roosevelt's sister Corinne recalled, they had so enjoyed one another's company that their laughs would mingle and reverberate through the corridors and rooms, and Edith would say, "It is always that way when they are together." The restoration of their old friendship, a matter more in Roosevelt's hands than in Taft's, was not simply a private concern. "No other friendship in our modern politics has meant more to the American people," William Allen White wrote, "for it has made two most important and devoted public servants wiser, kindlier, more useful men." "The whole country waits and wonders," the Baltimore Sun wrote in a prescient editorial. "Roosevelt seems to hold the future of his party in the hollow of his hand. Taft looks to him for succor. The insurgents know if they can win his support, the regulars will be swept away. Old leaders tremble, new aspirants take hope. His decision is important to the country, and even more important, to himself. Many another has risen to the heights of popularity to be dethroned in a day. Has Roosevelt reached the pinnacle of his fame, or is he to move forward to fresh conquests? It rests with him. He is at the height of his mental and physical powers. He possesses a great influence over the masses of his countrymen. Such power is a tremendous weapon, for good or evil. How will he wield it?" To understand the complex contours of this consequential friendship, however, we must go backward in time to analyze the similarities in life experiences that initially drew Roosevelt and Taft together, and the differences in temperament that now threatened to split them apart. Chapter 2. Will and Teedy. William Howard Taft was born on September 15, 1857, in a two-story yellow brick house in a fashionable neighborhood on Mount Auburn, one of the hills surrounding Cincinnati. 6 days after his birth, his father, Alfonso, proudly noted to a friend, Louise is getting along astonishingly well, and the baby is fat and healthy. In the hours after the birth, he explained, Louise had a fair prospect of milk, and on the third day the boy had plenty. But a few days later, the infant's clamorous appetite necessitated a wet nurse to supplement his mother's milk supply. The plump, ravenous new baby provided welcome relief to his parents. Their first child, Samuel, had been frail from birth and had died of whooping cough at 14 months, the year before Will was born. At 2 months, his mother recorded, Will was very large for his age and grows fat every day. Indeed, she noted with amazement and pride, he has such a large waist that he cannot wear any of the dresses that we made with belts. While his rapid growth kept her busy making ever larger clothes, she took great comfort in his perfect good health and his fullness of flesh. The care of him fills in some measure the void left by Sammy's death, she wrote to her mother, but I am constantly thinking how interesting Sammy would be now if he had lived, and how pleasant to have two little boys growing up together. Will's sweet, open nature was evident from infancy. He spreads his hands to anyone who will take him, and his face is wreathed in smiles at the slightest provocation, Louise told her sister, Delia Torrey. His parents admired his cherubic face, a solitary dimple in one cheek, his eyes deeply, darkly, beautifully blue. Finding great pleasure and solace in her healthy, fast-growing boy, Louise happily acquiesced to his insistence upon being held whenever he is awake, even if she felt her hands and feet were tied to the child. Mother would think it poor management, she confided to her sister Delia, but I do not understand making him take care of himself. Her torment at losing her firstborn had convinced her that children are treasures lent, not given, and they may be recalled at any time. Parents, she firmly believed, could never love their children too much. Louise Torrey came from a line of strong, intelligent women. Her mother, Susan Waters Torrey, had studied philosophy and astronomy at Amherst Academy and possessed a vibrant intellectual curiosity, an interest in anti-slavery politics, and an appreciation for art. Following her marriage to merchant Samuel Torrey, they settled in Boston, where she relished the rich culture and lively debates over the critical issues of the day. To her great disappointment, her husband, hopeful that country air would improve his health, moved the family to the small town of Millbury, Massachusetts. In Millbury, her spirits plummeted. She has great mental and physical activity, her daughter Delia noted, and there is not a man or woman in town with whom she can have any satisfactory intellectual conversation. Lacking any immediate outlet for her talents and energy, she shared the frustration of many educated women in the mid-19th century. Mother, you know, is very ambitious, Delia dryly wrote Louise, and ambition in a woman is synonymous with unhappiness. Resolved to give her daughters opportunity for intellectual development and involvement in a broader world, Susan Torrey exposed Louise and Delia to good literature, Lyceum lectures in Boston, theater in New York. They studied for a time in New Haven, Connecticut, and attended Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Cherishing their freedom, they taught at Monson Academy in Maine, studied music, attended opera, and traveled together through Canada, New England, and New York. Both rejected eligible suitors in favor of their own liberated lives. When one disappointed young man upbraided Delia for willfulness, she retorted, "If ladies of strong minds seldom marry, I suppose the reverse proves true, and ladies with weak minds usually do. I prefer to belong to the first class, even though it precluded me from marrying." Louise was 26 when she was introduced to 43-year-old Alfonso Taft at the home of her uncle, Reverend Samuel Dutton, pastor of North Church in New Haven, a meeting that would alter her existence in an unexpectedly domestic direction. Alfonso had grown up on a small farm in West Townsend, Vermont, the only child of Peter Rawson Taft and Sylvia Howard. One day in an oat field, he later recalled, he first told his father of his dream of going to college. The expense would be a hardship for the family, but to the boy's intense delight, his parents decided to support his education. To help out, Alfonso taught school in Vermont for several years before entering Yale. He made the 140-mile trek from Vermont to New Haven on foot. After graduating Phi Beta Kappa, he taught in a boarding school for 2 years and then returned to Yale, where he became a tutor and studied law. He had sacrificed so much and had been so earnest in his pursuit of an education, his youngest son, Horace, observed, that everything that he learned in college was sacred in his eyes. Although he had initially hoped to practice law in New York, a short stay there changed his mind. "I feel well assured I might make a living in that city, but I don't think it the place for me," he concluded. "I dislike the character of the New York bar exceedingly. Money is the all in all. Nothing else brings honor." He decided instead to go west, finding the Queen City of Cincinnati a far more congenial place. "There are no such high partition walls here between different classes," he wrote his mother. "Here and there a family is beginning to stiffen up and assume consequential airs, but they are comparatively few." Perhaps most significant to a man who had striven so hard for his own education, Alfonso found Cincinnati honorably famous for its free schools, as the visiting Charles Dickens noted, "of which it has so many that no person's child among its population can by possibility want the means of education." While studying for the Ohio bar, Alfonso clerked in the office of a fellow Vermonter with an established practice. In these early years, he depended for his livelihood on the small sums his parents could send. "I have not spent $1," he assured them in 1839, "not a farthing for any amusement or for anything which was not a matter of immediate and necessary use." With hard work and untiring discipline, he succeeded in building a successful practice that allowed him to buy the substantial two-story yellow brick house set back from the street on a stretch of green lawn. There he lived with his first wife, Fanny, an intelligent, scholarly young woman, until tuberculosis took her life at 29. She left him with 2 sons, Charlie, 10, and Peter, 6. Though Alfonso was 17 years older than Louise Torrey when they met in New Haven, his handsome face, muscular physique, and abundant energy bridged the years between them. She agreed to marry in 1853 and moved with him to Cincinnati, where she grew to love her noble husband with a heart full of a deep and quiet joy. For his part, Alfonso rejoiced in the affection Louise showed his 2 older sons, who came to love her as if she were their own mother. "I do feel under the greatest obligation to you, my dear Louise, for the great care and attention you have given to the lads," he wrote to her several years before Will's birth. Within months of her marriage, Louise confided in Delia that she had the best husband in the United States. For Delia, the loss of her sister's companionship was devastating. "Oh, Louise, Louise, how can I live the rest of my life without you?" she lamented. "I am but half a pair of scissors." As the months passed, however, the gentle Alfonso made Delia an integral part of her sister's new family. The family expanded rapidly after Will's birth, eventually containing 6 children, including Charlie and Peter. Henry Waters, always called Harry, was born 2 years after Will, followed quickly by Horace Dutton, and finally by a long-desired girl named Fanny, in honor of Alfonso's first wife. As the children grew, good-natured Will remained the center of his parents' affection. "I had more pride in Willie than in all the rest," Louise acknowledged. "Willie is foremost," agreed Alfonso, "and I'm inclined to think he will always be so." Rather than displaying the jealousy this favored status might easily have provoked, Will's siblings responded to his simplicity, courage, honesty, and kindliness, qualities he shared with his father, with devoted affection. If flattery or admiration could have spoiled him, he would have been ruined before he emerged from childhood, Horace recalled. His personality made him a favorite everywhere. His younger brother's fond dedication to Will never wavered. "It was very hard for anybody to be near him without loving him," Horace recollected when he had passed his 80th birthday. Even as his family grew and his career flourished, Alfonso Taft was rarely able to relinquish the rigid self-discipline that had enabled him to forge a comfortable existence. Scarcely a night would pass that he was not bent over a table deep in papers or books he had brought from his office, biographer Henry Pringle notes. We might almost as well ask a train of cars to